A collection of everything. So big it can never be catalogued or appraised. The loot of the world.
You got 5 seconds to tell me where you buried the loot. Where's the loot?
I don't know who's got the loot. I don't know if anybody's got the loot.
Hello, looters. Welcome to episode 36 of Thief's Monthly Movie Loot, the podcast where I talk about the loot of films I watch every month. Hope everybody's doing great, or as great as could be. As usual, I want to start by thanking everybody that has listened to our latest episodes. There's our latest special episode, which would be number 5, where I break out and analyze one specific scene from one of my favorite films, The Godfather Part 2. And there's the episode before that, the Oscars loot, in which me and my guest Eric Anderson from Awards Watch talk about the Oscars, from favorite past winners to his predictions about this year's ceremony, which was last week. First of all, Eric nailed most of his predictions. He missed like 3 of the ones we talk about here, which is great. As for the ceremony, some thoughts. Generally speaking, I like the format they chose with the tables and the presenters walking around the guests, addressing people directly instead of being up on the stage. It felt elegant, but intimate at the same time. I like the pace, even if it felt a bit breakneck towards the end. I think there are some things that can be fixed in that respect, but overall it was okay. I thought most of the speeches were good. I liked Fennell, Vinterberg, Kaluuya, Yu Jung. Now, the big thing for everybody was the last part. I respect the decision of the producers to shake up the order a bit. I didn't mind that they gave director in the middle of the show, but I thought they should have finished with picture. By favoring actress and actor, they set up themselves for a failure, which is made worse after the reports and comments that came out about the producers, where they admitted that they willingly left actor for last in order to capitalize from a potential win from the late Chadwick Boseman. And I think that was a bad decision, not only in terms of the intentions, but also in terms of logistics. Hopkins won, he wasn't there, and they didn't even know what to do, which resulted in an anticlimactic, abrupt ending. Again, the plot thickens when we find out that Hopkins offered to give an acceptance speech via Zoom if he won, and the Academy declined, and that makes no sense at all. So again, the Academy set themselves up for that, which is a shame, because if they hadn't changed the order, I think the overall reception would have been slightly better. But, c'est la vie. Putting that aside, I want to congratulate all of the winners. Here's to many more awards. Finally, here's a word from a good friend.
Was A Quiet Place inspired by Signs, It Comes at Night, and War for the Planet of the Apes? Was Ready Player One influenced by Avatar, Wreck-It Ralph, and The Last Starfighter? Is The Hurricane Heist more influenced by Sharknado or Geostorm? These are the kinds of questions my guest co-hosts and I discuss on my podcast, Piecing It Together. Every week, we look at a new movie and try to figure out what other movies inspired it, whether it's the story, the character development, tone, or even use of music. Every movie was influenced by something that came before, and we want to figure out what. Check out Piecing It Together on your favorite podcast app or check us out on piecingpod.com. You can also follow us on social media at @piecingpod. Piecing It Together is a part of the All Points West Podcast Network.
And that was David Rosen from the Piecing It Together podcast. Make sure you check out his stuff. He has recent episodes on The Lord of the Rings, Godzilla vs. Kong, In the Earth, Come True, Shiva Baby, The Empty Man, and many, many more. So check it out. As for today, here at Thief's Monthly Movie Loot, I'll be sharing my thoughts on some of the films I saw last month, the April Loot. As usual, I start every month with a set of random criteria to guide me on what to watch. Once again, I finished the month watching 16 films in total, including 3 rewatches. I'm going to focus my discussion on the top 5 or 6 and then give some quick thoughts on the others. So let's begin with my loot of films for April.
A film from the 1940s.
Al ladro! Al ladro! Che ti è successo? Monta, monta! Vai a pezzo, corri! Corri, dai! Corri! Avverti il tunnel, l'ho visto io!
For this category, I went with Ladri di Biciclette, Bicycle Thieves, from Vittorio Da Sica. This is a film I had been meaning to see for a long time, but for one reason or another hadn't gotten around to. It is set in post-World War II Italy, and it follows Antonio, a poor man looking for a bicycle that was stolen from him, which he desperately needs to keep a job. You see, Antonio, played by Lamberto Maggiorani, like many other Italians during this time, desperately needs to support his family. He has a wife and two young children, and this job represents a steady income and ultimately food on the table. Through Antonio's predicament, the film manages to show how chaotic the economic situation was in Italy after the war. You see crowds of people looking for work, a towering stack of belongings that have been pawned at the shop, and the push and shove of people trying to get on a bus to get to work. In a country so affected by war, any work is a lifeline, and that lifeline is represented by this bicycle. Maggiorani perfectly portrays that desperation and hopelessness through his eyes, his face, and his body language. He is joined in the search by his young son Bruno, played by Enzo Staiola, who also does a great job of showing mixtures of frustration and confusion amidst all of this. I think his acting in the second half of the film is masterful, but what I love most about the film is how it blurs the lines between so-called good and bad as the plot progresses. The film really makes us reevaluate our feelings towards the end as we see Antonio grow more and more desperate. This film was definitely worth the wait and is strongly recommended for anyone looking for a powerful drama. My friend Phil Sagan at Phil_Sagan said, Bicycle Thieves, a classic, 10 out of 10. So if you want to see it, it is currently streaming free on HBO Max and the Criterion channel.
A drama film.
Mi vida entera fue mirar para adelante. Atrás no es mi jurisdicción. Me declaro incompetente.
For this category, I saw a bunch of films that I would casually rank pretty much at the same level. So here goes. First, I went with a film from Argentina, El Secreto de Sus Ojos, The Secret in Their Eyes from 2009. This film uses a non-linear narrative, moving back and forth between the 1970s and 1990s. It follows Benjamin Esposito, played by Ricardo Darín, a former deputy in Buenos Aires who investigated the rape and murder of a young woman. A case that didn't end up the way he would have wanted. 2 decades later, he's still haunted by it and starts writing a novel about it. During his investigation, Esposito is assisted by Pablo, played by Guillermo Franchella, an alcoholic but dependable friend, and Irene, played by Soledad Villamil, his superior who reluctantly helps him at first, but eventually realizes that he might be right about the investigation. Even though Esposito and Irene are obviously smitten with each other, they never dare to share their feelings. This is a film I had seen mentioned many times, but that I really didn't know much about. Still, it certainly wasn't what I expected, in a good way. The film manages to tread along different genres without losing a beat, whether it's a psychological thriller, a crime drama, romance, or even hints of historic epic, as it weaves Argentina's historical and political history into the plot. But the thrilling aspect is the one that is more evident through the film, particularly during a breathtaking sequence in a soccer stadium, which features an impressive 5-minute long shot that had me on the edge of my seat all the way. I do think they could have shortened it a bit, and my cynical self thinks the epilogue wasn't entirely necessary, but after 2+ hours of following the characters, I think they earned it. The Secret in Their Eyes is available for rent in most streaming platforms, so give it a shot.
Taina ha detto che tu hai due amori e che non sai scegliere fra i due, giornalismo e letteratura. Attento alla prigione, stai libero, disponibile, come me. Non sposate niente, non scelga mai. Anche nell'amore è meglio essere scelto. Great thing is to burn and not to freeze.
For the second drama film, I went to Italy. La Dolce Vita, from Federico Fellini. The film follows journalist and womanizer Marcello, played by Marcello Mastroianni, as he navigates through Rome's nightlife and lifestyle of the rich and famous. The film is split into 7 separate vignettes or chapters, through which we see Marcello struggling with his relationship with volatile fiancée Emma, played by Yvonne Fournot, and also going about his job as a gossip columnist and socialite, while mingling with celebrities and wallowing in the excesses of sex and drinking. The thing is that deep down, Marcello craves a more meaningful life, which he confesses to his friend Steiner, played by Alain Cooney, who is living this life he desires. Marcello is a tough character to analyze, mostly because he's not entirely likable. He's a womanizer, he's unfaithful, has outbursts of violence and excesses. Also, the fact that every single woman he meets fall at his feet made me roll my eyes often. To add to his complicated persona, Marcello's job is also not the most liked. But as a middle-aged man myself, I can't help but sympathize with his search for meaning and purpose, even if I disagree with the ways he goes about it. My friend Phil Sagan said, La Dolce Vita, not as great as I expected, 7.5 out of 10. La Dolce Vita is a visually striking film with lots of symbolism, so if you're into that, then by all means check it out.
You are a liar. You're an imposter. You're a deserter.
Seems to me little more than a common opportunist. I don't think he loves my mother at all.
For my third drama film, I went to England with a rewatch of Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon. The film follows the exploits of the titular Irishman, played by Ryan O'Neill, an opportunist that comes from humble means but sets himself to become an aristocrat at any cost during the 18th century. But the thing is that Lyndon is, by all means, an insignificant person that fights in insignificant skirmishes during the war and gets involved in insignificant romances. His life history is bookended by insignificant duels for insignificant reasons, all while he aspires to achieve significance to no avail. I remember that the first time I saw this, I was a bit lukewarm to it, but this time I ended up appreciating it a lot more. Like most Kubrick films, there's the theme of dehumanization, as Lyndon is dehumanized by his desire to climb the social ladder, which he briefly achieves, but to the expense of everyone around him. It is ironic that Kubrick's original idea was to make a biopic about Napoleon, a man of allegedly small stature but great achievements, but then went the other way to make a film about Lyndon, a tall man, since O'Neill is 6'1", but again of insignificant achievements. O'Neill may not be the best actor, and it shows in the few emotional moments from his character, but I think that lack of emotion suited the role. But aside from Lyndon's ups and downs, what takes center stage on this film is the amazing direction, the cinematography, set design, and overall production values. The film is one of the most gorgeous films I've seen. Every shot seems to be taken from a painting. My friend Phil Sagan said, Barry Lyndon, a classic, 10 out of 10. And my friend Kerem Maliki Sanchez at K Maliki Sanchez, he said, Barry Lyndon, telephoto shots, lit only by candlelight. Referring to how many scenes were only lit by candlelight, which made for some impressive cinematography. Barry Lyndon might still not be at the top of the ladder among Kubrick films for me, but it certainly gained more significance this time around. If you want to see it, it's streaming free on HBO Max.
A film nominated for a Best Picture or Best International Feature Film this year.
Afhældning. Daglig indtagelse af alkohol.
Ja.
Tilstræbt til konstant niveau på en halv promille.
Med henblik på indsamling af evidens,
ja,
om psykologiske
og psykoretoriske følgevirkninger samt undersøgelse af forøget social og faglig ydeevne.
Det er kun i arbejdstiden, vi drikker, ikke?
Men det er jo ligesom Hemingway. Vi drikker ikke efter 8 og ikke i weekenden.
Er I klar? Rejs op!
I had this category obviously because of the Oscars, and one of the films I saw for it was Another Round. The film follows Martin, played by Mads Mikkelsen, a middle-aged teacher who finds himself immersed in a typical midlife crisis, along with his three friends and colleagues, a boring job, routine marriage, yada yada. Suddenly inspired by a psychiatrist's theory that argued that a low alcohol content made you more creative, they decide to put it to the test by working while being a little, well, tipsy. Although the quote-unquote experiment has great results at first, eventually things spiral out of control as they push the limits. I don't think I knew much about this film until the Oscar noms were announced, and maybe that's why I was pleasantly surprised by it. Even though the premise of revitalized middle-aged men is not new, and the film follows the typical template of those films, it is held together by great performances from the cast, especially Mikkelsen. He really digs deep into the depression, frustration, and emotional chaos of this character as he goes up and down the wave of alcoholism. Another thing I liked is how the film juxtaposed the dangerous effects of alcoholism with the many ways that society pushes alcohol onto us since our youth. That said, there is a subplot about a student that is having trouble with some tests and is sort of pushed into drinking by one of Martin's colleagues, but that subplot kind of gets lost in the shuffle. Other than that, the film manages to successfully sustain a tone that, in a weird way, feels both bleak and hopeful, which I think goes rather well with the circumstances behind the film and the death of director and writer Thomas Vinterberg's daughter. If you want to check it out, Another Round is streaming free on Hulu.
A biblical film.
Damien, it's all for you.
Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. That is the verse that inspires and closes the 1976 horror classic The Omen. I went with this category because of Easter, and when I saw this was streaming free on Hulu, I didn't hesitate. This is a film I used to watch a lot when I was a kid, and I ended up memorizing that Bible verse. I think it was the first Bible verse I ever memorized, but such was the impact that this film had in me and my brothers as we grew up. One of dread of something mysterious, unknown, and incredibly evil. The Omen follows Richard Thorne, played by Gregory Peck, a US diplomat that accepts to take over an orphan baby boy after his wife's stillbirth, but decides to keep it secret from her. What Thorne doesn't know is that the boy is actually the Antichrist himself, who ends up wreaking havoc in Thorne's life and those around him. Even though I hadn't seen the film in a good while, it is one that has stuck with me through all my life, from that verse I mentioned to the kid's look, the gory deaths, and that freaking score, which I still think is as creepy and eerie as ever. Maybe I shouldn't have seen the film at all back then, let alone so many times, but as a kid that was raised in the church, the fear of hell, Satan, or the Antichrist was as serious as it could be, which maybe adds to why it left such a lasting impression in me. Director Richard Donner builds a unique atmosphere of dread through his direction, the music, the use of light and shadows, and how about that haunting scene with the nanny in the first act? Unfortunately, I do think that Donner lets the film get away from his hands towards the last act. Some of the death scenes are too exaggerated, and I think a bit of restraint would have been better. Plus the way that the last act unfolds with Thorne willingly agreeing to sacrifice his 5-year-old son, it asks a lot from the audience. Regardless of that, I still think it's an awfully effective horror film still to this day. My friend Phil Sagan said The Omen, a horror classic, 9 out of 10. While Jolene from the It Goes Down in the PM podcast, she said, The Omen is scary and you feel like a terrible person because you root for something terrible to happen to a child. I went back and forth from He's a kid, he can be talked to do better, to He's Satan's spawn. Interesting, albeit disturbing take on the classic nature versus nurture debate. Every scene with his nanny gave me that sick feel in the pit of my stomach. And she's right. I think that all the scenes with both nannies are great. That's why I opened the segment with one of those scenes, which is probably my favorite from the film. The Omen is currently available to rent on most streaming platforms.
A freebie.
We are not terrorists, you understand. We are patriots. Our duty is to the soldiers who died fighting in Algeria, and to the 3 million French citizens who have always lived there.
So you want to get rid of him?
Speaking as a professional, do you think it's possible?
It's possible.
The point is getting away with it.
And speaking as a professional, that's a very important consideration.
But in principle, you'd say it could be done.
Yes. With enough time and planning. Would be much more difficult than most other targets.
Why more?
Because de Gaulle is the best security service in the world. Their information is first class. You see, gentlemen, not only have your own efforts failed, but you've rather cleared the pitch for everyone else.
How dare you suggest that?
Work. You simply can't afford to be emotional. Why you've made so many mistakes.
The Day of the Jackal follows the meticulous attempts of an assassin codenamed the Jackal, played by Edward Fox, who is hired to assassinate French President Charles de Gaulle. The Jackal goes at his task with careful planning, a lot of patience, and no emotion, while law enforcement, led by skilled investigator Claude Lebel, played by Michael Lonsdale, makes numerous attempts to locate him and stop him. There is an interesting contrast between both Lebel and the Jackal, since both of them are extremely meticulous and skilled at their work. Much like the Jackal himself, there is a cold and distant approach to the film from director Fred Zinnemann, but for the most part it works. Like a great procedural, we see how the Jackal and Lebel try to outsmart the other, but the focus is on the Jackal all the way. It is the kind of film where, even though you know he's a bad guy, you're kinda rooting for him, and Fox makes the most of the role. Zinnemann's direction is tight and tense, and the editing is superb. However, although I appreciate his bare-bones, emotionless approach, part of me wishes that Lebel was a bit more fleshed out, or that the climax and the ending weren't as abrupt as they were. But as it is, this is a tight, neat little thriller. If you wanna give it a shot, The Day of the Jackal is streaming free on Stars. So, that was my prelude, or what I think were the best films I saw this month. Bicycle Thieves, Barry Lyndon, La Dolce Vita, The Day of the Jackal, The Secret in Their Eyes, The Omen, and Another Round. But like I said, those were not the only ones, so I also want to touch briefly on the other films I saw this month. My minor loot, if you will. So let's go.
A film with Anthony Perkins.
Anthony Perkins was born on April 4, so I wanted to see one of his films. I went with On the Beach, a 1959 post-apocalyptic drama that I hadn't heard about, but as soon as I read the synopsis, I was intrigued. Set in an alternate reality where World War III has devastated half the planet, the film follows a group of survivors sheltered in Australia. As radiation threatens to reach them, they scramble for options while also coping with the oncoming death. Aside from Perkins, the film stars Gregory Peck, Ava Gardner, and Fred Astaire, who was great, and despite some excessive melodrama here and there, I thought it was a surprisingly bleak and powerful film.
A drama film.
Another drama film I saw was Beast of the Southern Wild from 2012, which I had already seen back in the day. Set in an isolated fictional community in New Orleans called The Bathtub, the film follows the lives of 6-year-old Hush Puppy, played by Kuwanshane Wallace, and her father Wink, played by Dwight Henry. The two live in extreme poverty as they struggle to take care of each other, their lives broken by past events like the abandonment of Hush Puppy's mother or Wink's deteriorating health. To make matters worse, a huge storm lashes the community, leaving its residents to fend for themselves. This is a film that, for the most part, is very well crafted, despite some melodrama. Also, director Ben Seidlin tries to integrate a fantasy element to the plot that doesn't quite work, but still this time I felt a stronger connection and more of a punch from both lead characters, who are perfectly acted.
A film from Iran.
Iran celebrated Islamic Republic Day in April, so I wanted to see something from there. Somebody had recommended to me a 2016 psychological horror film called Under the Shadow that was on Netflix, so that's where I went. The film is set in the 1980s in the middle of the war with Iraq and follows Shideh, played by Narges Rachidi, a young woman that is forbidden from resuming her medical studies after being involved in leftist groups during the revolution. As war intensifies and her husband is called to service, Shideh has to take care of their daughter Dorsa, played by Abin Manshadi, while also dealing with a mysterious presence that starts haunting them as well as her own fears and insecurities. Despite a slow pace, the film is pretty solid, with a nicely built dread and atmosphere, good camera handling, and some effective jump scares. I had some issues with the ending, but I still would recommend it.
Any film that starts with the letters G or H.
For this category, I went with 1975's Hard Times. Set in the 1930s, the film follows the struggles of Chaney, played by Charles Bronson, a hardened and stoic man that moves from town to town, making ends meet in illegal street fights. After pairing up with Speed, a shady hustler played by James Coburn, Chaney's pedigree and fighting schedule ramps up, while also putting them at odds with some dangerous elements in the town. This is a film that excels at simplicity. There's really not a lot going on, just this man fighting his way up the ladder, but it works. There are some attempts to flesh him out with a romantic relationship, but there's not much to that either. Speed, on the other hand, is a more complex character, and I liked how Coburn played that ambiguity. My friend Phil Sagan said, Hard Times, great gritty drama, 8 out of 10. Overall, this is a reliable and efficient film, and a lot of fun to watch.
A film with the number 4 in its title.
For this category, I decided to check out the 2015 documentary Doomed, the untold story of Roger Corman's The Fantastic Four. Like the title says, it follows the troubled production of this film that was being produced by Corman along with Constantin Film, but that, according to some of the people interviewed, was never meant to see the light of day. These intentions, however, were kept from the cast and crew, most of which were counting on the film to advance their careers and devoted personal time and money to complete it. The documentary features extensive interviews with all of the main cast, as well as director Oli Sasson, editor Glenn Garland, and writer Craig J. Nevius. And it is an extremely interesting look into what they describe as the seedy dark side of Hollywood that ended up stabbing them in the back. And of course, after watching the documentary, what was left for me to do? Watch the real thing, of course. Even though the 1994 Fantastic Four film was never released, it has found some life as bootleg copies that can be found all through the internet. The film is a typical origin story for the superhero team, with Dr. Reed Richards, played by Alex Hyde-White, and his friends Sue, Johnny, and Ben trying to deal with the effects of cosmic rays from a comet in their bodies after a trip to space. In the meantime, Richards' former friend and colleague Victor Von Doom, played by Joseph Culp, is trying to gather the energy from the same comet or something like that. In many ways, the story behind the scenes is much more interesting than the film itself, but it also helps to put in perspective the final product. So considering this was made by a notoriously low-budget studio on a shoestring budget and a rush schedule by B-list actors and crew members that were sneaking film reels out of the studio to do post-production sound, special effects, and whatnot on cheap stores, the end result is better than one would think. It is campy, goofy, with more in common with the 60s Batman than the 1989 one. Dialogue is cringy and most of the performances are pretty bad, but I still think there's some fun to be had by watching it, especially after watching the documentary. The documentary is available on Vudu, Tubi, and Pluto, and the film can be found around.
A film mostly set in a submarine.
National Submarine Day was on April 11, so I wanted to check out a film set on one. The Wolf's Call, which is on Netflix, had some decent scores, so I decided to check it out. This French film follows a group of sailors aboard two separate submarines, the Formidable, a nuclear submarine led by Captain Grancham, played by Rita Kateb, and the Titan, led by Captain Dorsey, played by Omar Sy, which will escort the Formidable to the sea. It is there that both sides will have to face extremely challenging decisions. But the focus of the story is on Chanterade, played by Francois Civil, a sonar expert who has quote-unquote golden ears and specializes in underwater acoustics. His hearing is so acute that he can identify boats, submarines, sea animals based only on their sounds, which puts the safety of his fellow sailors heavily on his shoulders. Overall, the film does a lot of good things right, direction is tight, and the tension during the attack scenes is effectively executed, especially during the opening 20 minutes. Unfortunately, Chanterade is not a very interesting character, and the performance from Civil is pretty bland and whiny, but when the focus changes to Grandchamp or Dorsey, it manages to stay afloat.
A film nominated for a Best Picture or Best International Feature Film this year.
For this category, I went with David Fincher's Mank. This is another one I wanted to see for two reasons. First, I'm a fan of Fincher, especially his early films. And second, it was nominated to 10 Oscars, so even though there wasn't a lot of buzz around it, I wanted to see what it was all about. The film is loosely based in real life and follows problematic screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz, played by Gary Oldman, as he deals with the struggle to write Citizen Kane, as well as how he navigated the perilous waters of Hollywood life in the years prior, while dealing with his own alcoholism. Much like Mank, The Person, the film is technically sound with lots of things on its favor, but a lot of issues as well. I found the script too spotty and the direction distant, the way that Mank's relationships unfold, be it with Marion Davies, his brother Joe, his secretary Rita, or his wife Sarah, wasn't the best, and it really didn't succeed in grabbing me. Much like Mankiewicz himself, there's skill and there's wit in the film, but the issues around it don't let those shine.
A film from the Criterion Collection whose number includes the number 4.
And finally, for this category, I went with Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless. The film follows Michel, played by Jean-Paul Belmondo, a small-time criminal who is on the run after shooting a cop, so he seeks refuge with Patricia, played by Jean Seberg, a former love interest that is an aspiring journalist. Even though she doesn't know much about Michel, his past, or even that he's on the run, she still spends most of the film resisting his romantic advances or dancing around the idea of being with him as they wander carefree around Paris. With this, I might incur in the wrath of film Twitter and cinephiles everywhere, but I really didn't connect with this at all. I can appreciate its technical aspects, editing and whatnot, as well as its contributions to cinema, but that's it. First, Michel is by his own admission an asshole, but more important, I didn't think his story or his interactions with Patricia were interesting enough. But I know I'm in the minority. My friend Kerem Maliki Sanchez said, "All Godard films leave me breathless." So I hope you're not mad about this. On the other hand, Phil Sagan said about Breathless, the same as La Dolce Vita, not as great as I expected, and he gave it 6 out of 10. So at least he agrees with me. So if you want to check it out, Breathless is streaming free on HBO Max and the Criterion channel. So those were my thoughts on the 16 films I saw during the month of April. Now that May has started, I've already settled on the categories for the next loot, which would be a film with the number 5 in its title, a film with a title that starts with the letters I or J, a film from the Criterion Collection whose number includes the number 5, a film from the 1950s, a fantasy film, a film about mothers, a film with a bird in its title, a film mostly set on a train, a film from Romania, and a film from Howard Hawks. So as usual, if you have any recommendation for any of those categories, let me know. You can contact me primarily via Twitter at TiffCGT or at the podcast account at TMML2021. Now it's time for
Useless Movie Trivia.
When director Richard Donner was casting the role of Damien, the kid Antichrist, for The Omen, he took a bunch of little boys and told them to, quote-unquote, come at him. Harvey Stephens screamed and clawed at Donner's face and even kicked him in the groin. Donner took him off and immediately cast him for the role. Goes to prove that being a bratty kid can have its advantages. So that was it for
Useless Movie Trivia.
And that's it for today. Remember to stay tuned for our next episode sometime in the middle of May, where we will have another guest discussing another interesting topic. Also follow us on Twitter or Instagram so you can stay up to date on all the episodes we release. Whenever you're listening, share the link so more people can join us in the loot. Episode 36 is over. Thanks for listening, people, and keep looting.
Marion, I need a favor. It's just a little joke, I'm willing.
Sure, Mank, anything.
I want you to go back and tell Mayor Willie wants the phony Sinclair films pulled.
Which phony Sinclair films?
There isn't time to explain. I just need you to tell him that.
Oh, I couldn't, not even as a joke.
Why not?
You know I don't lie.
And that's why he'd believe you. Marion, please, you're not in combat school anymore.
I'm sorry, I know it's silly, but...
But what? Why not?
Promise you won't laugh.
I promise I won't laugh.
My exit.
What?
I already made my exit.